Listening to Talk Geek to Me News number 71, recorded for Wednesday, August 8th, 2012. You are listening to the Tech Only Hacker Public Radio Edition. To get the full podcast, including political commentary and other controversial topics, please visit www.talkgeektome.us. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. Before I get into tech news, I want to once again thank my listeners for sticking by me through my need to take 2 months of vacation time from the podcast. My family and myself thank all of you for sticking with me. The time was just needed. My life is not completely my own. What else can I say? The HOPE conference was absolutely amazing. If you go to my website, www.talkgeektome.us, and click the blog link, put a little post where I gave a link to the whole list of show talks in MP3 format on the web, and I gave hot links directly to 5 ones that I know to be excellent. If you want to take advantage of that, please help yourself. And now, the Tech Roundup. From EFF.org, Day of July 4th, 2012, by Eva Galperin. Open source developer Basil Kotabil detained in Syria. This weekend, the EFF learned that Basil Kotabil, a longtime member of the open source community and Creative Commons volunteer, has been detained in Syria since March 12, 2012, as part of a wave of arrests made in the Mezzeh district of Damascus. For months, Basil's family has had no knowledge of his whereabouts or the reason for his arrest. Only recently have they heard from previous detainees at Kafr Susa that he is being held at this location. This news is especially alarming in light of the recent Human Rights Watch report documenting the use of torture in 27 detention facilities run by Syrian intelligence agencies. In addition to his work as technical director on several projects, including efforts to restore the Palmyra Atoll and the publication of Forward Syria magazine, Basil contributed his time and expertise to countless organizations including Creative Commons, Mozilla Firefox, Wikipedia, the Open Clip Art Library, Fabricators, Shaarism, and the Arab bloggers community. More than 1,000 people from all over the world have already signed a letter of support for Basil, addressed to the Syrian government requesting information about his detention, health, and psychological state, and demanding his immediate release. They are also tweeting their support using the hashtag FreeBasil. EFF joins Basil's friends, family, and colleagues in calling for his release and condemns the Syrian government, which has held him for almost 4 months without charges or a trial. From TorrentFreak.com, Day of June 28, 2012, by Ben Jones. Mega upload search warrants ruled illegal by High Court. A case that seemed, just 5 months ago, to be a veritable David and Goliath fight is certainly living up to its billing. The battle between Mega Upload David and the U.S. government and the MPAA Goliath started out with a flurry of blows against the New Zealand-based site staff, but in recent weeks the blows have all been falling stateside. Today, the New Zealand High Court ruled that the search warrants used to raid .com's mansion were illegal, casting uncertainty over the entire Mega conspiracy case. An earlier ruling by High Court Justice Judith Potter concluded that a previous search and seizure order was invalid because of improper paperwork. The documents were later corrected. In the ruling, Chief Justice Helen Winkleman declared the warrants illegal, noting that they were not adequately descriptive of the offenses .com was accused of. Indeed, they fell short of that. They were general warrants, and as such are invalid, she said. In addition, the data removed from New Zealand by the FBI, which they claim was not stolen since it was only data, was also ruled to be illegally obtained and should not have been taken out of the country. Quote, the release of cloned hard drives to the FBI for shipping to the United States was contrary to the February 16th direction under Section 49, Subpart 2 of the MACMA, Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters Act, that the items seized were to remain in custody and control of the Commissioner of Police. This dealing with the cloned hard drives was therefore in breach of Section 49, Subpart 3 of the MACMA, unquote. Winkleman also voiced concerns over police conduct, questioning if their actions in January amounted to unreasonable search and seizure, with a preliminary view that they did. Along with these concerns came a note that the raid could be considered trespass by the police, not something the elite anti-terrorist team used for the raid will want on their record. Perhaps the biggest setback for any prosecution relates to what evidence was collected. An independently and appropriately experienced High Court lawyer will now conduct a review of the evidence to determine what is and is not relevant to the charges .com faces. Anything deemed not relevant will be returned to .com and not provided to the U.S. Anything deemed relevant will be copied to both .com and U.S. authorities for use in court. While the ruling does not amount to the unequivocal quashing of the search warrants and the invalidation of any evidence collected through them, it is a significant win for .com. Meanwhile, a request for the cloned hard drives to be returned, presumably without being copied, has been made to U.S. authorities. The amount of respect for the New Zealand legal system held by the U.S. authorities may be inferred by the time it takes to comply with the request. As for the extradition hearing, that's still going ahead. From TechDirt.com, dated July 2, 2012, by Mike Masnick, Congress plays see no evil, pretend there's no evil, let the evil continue with NSA domestic spying. We're still completely perplexed at how anyone in Congress could recognize that the NSA has refused to tell Congress how often it's violated the privacy of Americans without a warrant under the FISA Amendments Act, the FAA. And then still vote to renew it. What kind of oversight is that? As Julian Sanchez recently wrote, it's no oversight at all. As he notes, the law requires the NSA to prevent the spying on folks when both parties in communication are in the U.S., but here the NSA is admitting that it has no mechanism to do that. Either A, it's lying, or B, it's admitting that it cannot do what the law requires. Extended quote, if we care about the spirit as well as the letter of that constraint being respected, it ought to be a little disturbing that the NSA has admitted it doesn't have any systematic mechanism for identifying communications with U.S. endpoints. Similar considerations apply to the minimization procedures, which are supposed to limit the retention and dissemination of information about U.S. persons. How meaningfully can these be applied if there's no systematic effort to detect when a U.S. person is party to a communication? End block quote. Normally, this should be the point at which Congress steps in and says no more to the NSA. Instead, it shuns those who even ask the basic questions. And as in the case of Representative Dan Lundgren, pretends that as long as no one proves to them that the NSA is abusing its power, there is simply no reason to demand evidence. That's not oversight. That's willful ignorance. And given that they're choosing to ignore their own oversight obligations over the NSA spying on Americans, it should come as no surprise that the House Intelligence Committee unanimously voted to extend the FAA for 5 more years. Why not? It's not like Congress is actually going to make sure that the NSA is playing by the rules. The NSA apparently just needs to say that it would be too much work to do what the law requires, and Congress says, here, have a gift of 5 more years to spy on Americans against the specifics of the law. And once again, as Sanchez points out, there are plenty of ways that the NSA could at least estimate how many Americans they're spying on. But why would it do that? As Sanchez points out, the NSA seems to redact anything even remotely embarrassing from its reports, including data on how often it failed to follow the law. extended quote, "While generally these reports contain a good deal of redacted statistical information that there is simply no plausible excuse for keeping secret. A table of statistical data relating to compliance incidents, for example, is included, but entirely blacked out. Are we to believe that the National Security Agency of the United States would be imperiled if the public knew the number of times the NSA had difficulty following the law? The review has concluded that the number of compliance incidents remains small, particularly when compared with the total amount of activity. But is there any legitimate reason for barring the public from knowing what counts as a small number, or just how massive the total amount of activity truly is? How do folks in Congress who vote for this kind of thing defend such actions? They can't say that's to protect Americans when they refuse to even seek to get the data on whether or not Americans are being illegally spied on." From TechDebt.com, dated July 2nd, 2012, by Mike Masnick. "You don't own what you buy, part 15,332. Cisco forces questionable new firmware on routers." One of the things that we keep learning in the connected digital age is that what you think you bought, you often don't really own. Companies who sell you products seem to feel a certain freedom to unilateral change the terms of your purchase after the fact. I'm reminded of Sony removing key features of the PS3, though there are plenty of other examples. A new one is the story of Cisco pushing out a firmware update to routers without customer approval, and even worse, having that firmware update block people from logging in directly to their own routers. Apparently, if you don't like it, too bad. Quote, "Cisco has started automatically pushing the company's new Cloud Connect firmware update to consumer routers without customer approval. Annoyed users note that the update won't let customers directly log into their routers anymore. They have to register for a new Cloud Connect account. The only way to revert to directly accessing your device you paid for, you have to unplug it from the internet." Oh, and registering for such an account means you have to agree to give up your data so that Cisco can sell it. As per the terms, "We may keep track of certain information related to your use of the service, including but not limited to the status and health of your network and network products, which apps relating to the service you are using, which features you are using within the service infrastructure, network traffic, i.e. megabytes per hour, internet history, how frequently you encounter errors on the service system, and other related information. Other information. We use this other information to help us quickly and efficiently respond to inquiries and requests and to enhance or administer our overall service for our customers. We may also use this other information for traffic analysis, for example, determining when the most customers are using the service and to determine which features within the service are most or least effective and useful to you. In addition, we may periodically transmit system information to our servers in order to optimize your overall experience with the service. We may share aggregated and anonymous user experience information with service providers, contractors, and other third parties." End quote. Seems like a good way to drive people into buying routers from other companies. I can see how a cloud service could have value, but it should be presented to users as a choice, where the actual benefit to them, if there is one, is clearly presented. Instead, this rollout seems designed solely to benefit Cisco and its partners, rather than the people who bought, or so they thought, their routers. From perspectives.mvderona.com, dated July 13, 2012, by James Hamilton. "Why are there data centers in New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo? Why are there so many data centers in New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo? These urban centers have some of the most expensive real estate in the world. The cost of the labor is high, the tax environment is unfavorable, power costs are high, construction is difficult to permit, and expensive. Urban data centers are incredibly expensive facilities, and yet a huge percentage of the world's computing is done in expensive urban centers. One of my favorite examples is the 111 8th Avenue data center in New York. Google bought this data center for $1.9 billion. They already have facilities on the Columbia River where the power and land are cheap. Why go to New York when neither is true? Google is innovating and cooling technologies in their Belgium facility, where they are using wastewater cooling. Why go to New York, where the facility is conventional, the power source predominantly coal-sourced, and the opportunity for energy innovation is restricted by legacy design and the lack of real estate available in the area around the facility? It's pretty clear that 111 8th Avenue isn't going to be wind farm powered. A solar array could likely be placed on the roof, but that wouldn't have the capacity to run the interior lights in this large facility. See I Love Solar But for more on the space challenges of solar power at data center powered densities. There isn't space to do anything relevant along these dimensions. Google has some of the most efficient data centers in the world, running on some of the cleanest power sources in the world, and custom engineered from the ground up to meet their needs. Why would they buy an old facility in a very expensive metropolitan area with a legacy design? Are they nuts? Of course not. Google is in New York because many millions of Google customers are in New York or nearby. Companies site data centers near the customers of those data centers. Why not serve the planet from Iceland, where the power is both cheap and clean? When your latency budget to serve customers is 200 milliseconds, you can't give up 3/4 of that time budget on speed of light delays traveling long distances. Just crossing the continent from California to New York is 74 milliseconds round-trip time. New York to London is 70 milliseconds round-trip time. The speed of light is unbending. Actually, it's even worse than the speed of light, in that the speed of light in a fiber is about 2/3 of the speed of light in a vacuum. See Communicating Beyond the Speed of Light. Because of the cruel realities of the speed of light, companies must site data centers where their customers are. That's why companies selling worldwide often need to have data centers all over the world. That's why the Akamai Content Distribution Network has over 12,000 points of presence worldwide. To serve customers competitively, you need to be near those customers. The reason data centers are located in Tokyo, New York, London, Singapore, and other expensive metropolitan locations is they need to be near customers or near data that is in those locations. It costs considerably to maintain data centers all over the world, but there is little alternative. Many articles recently have been quoting the Greenpeace open letter asking Ballmer, Bezos, and Cook to go to Iceland. See, for example, letter to Ballmer, Bezos, and Cook, go to Iceland. Having come many of these articles recently, it seemed worth stopping and reflecting on why this hasn't already happened. It's not like companies just love paying more or using less environmentally friendly power sources for their data centers. Google is in New York because it has millions of customers in New York. If it were physically possible to serve those customers from an already built hyper-efficient data center like Google Dale's, they certainly would, but the facility is 70 millisecond round trip away from New York. What about Iceland? Roughly the same distance. It simply doesn't work. Comparatively, companies build near their users because physics of the speed of light is unbending and uncaring. So what can we do? It turns out that many workloads are not latency sensitive. The right strategy is to house latency sensitive workloads near customers or the data needed at low latency and house latency insensitive workloads optimizing on other dimensions. This is exactly what Google does, but to do that, you need to have many data centers all over the world. So the appropriate facility can be selected on a workload-by-workload basis. This isn't a practical approach for many smaller companies with only one or two data centers to choose from. This is another area where cloud computing can help. Cloud computing can allow mid-sized and even small companies to have many different data centers optimized for different goals all over the world. Using AWS, a company can house workloads near customers in Singapore, Tokyo, Brazil, and Ireland to be close to their international customers. Being close to these customers makes a big difference in the overall quality of customer experience, as well as allowing a company to cost-effectively have an international presence. Cloud computing also allows companies to make careful decisions on where they locate workloads in North America. Again, using AWS as an example, customers can place workloads in Virginia to serve the East Coast or use Northern California to serve the population-dense California region. if the workloads are not latency sensitive or is serving customers near the Pacific Northwest, they can be housed in AWS Oregon region, where the workload can be hosted coal-free and less expensively than in Northern California. The reality is that physics is uncaring, and many workloads do not need to be close to users. Cloud computing allows all companies to have access to data centers all over the world, so they can target individual workloads to the facilities that most closely meet their goals and the needs of their customers. Some computing will have to stay in New York, even though it is mostly coal-powered, expensive, and difficult to expand. But some workload will run very economically in the AWS West Oregon region, where there is no coal power, expansion is cheap, and power inexpensive. Workload placement decisions are more complex than move to Iceland. News from TechDirt.com, Perspective.mvdorona.com, and MaggieMcNeil.wordpress.com, used under arranged permission. News from TorrentFreak.com and EFF.org, used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution license. News from DemocracyNow.org and WLCentral.org, used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. News from JillStein.org is a press release. News sources retain their respective copyrights. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. This episode of Talk Geek to Me is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported license. This license allows commercial reuse of the work, as well as allowing you to modify the work, so long as you share alike the same rights you have received under this license. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.